VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
Friends, we thank you for joining us today. You're going to be hearing things on this program you will not be getting from your nightly newscast or from any mainstream media across this nation. The United Nations Climate Change Conference, it's underway right now, Madrid, Spain. It's known as COP25. It's to be a follow-up on the implementation of the Paris Climate Change Accord. Politicians and activists from all over the world have significantly increased their carbon footprint by flying in and flying out, warning about the impact of carbon emissions. Makes sense, doesn't it? Last Thursday, there was a protest in London in which the Western Journal reported actress Emma Thompson cited the possibility of eating pets due to the impacts of climate change. Warnings are being given about ice caps melting at a rapid rate, sea levels rising, oceans are acidifying, threatening all marine life. Incidentally, the Obamas just bought some oceanfront property in Martha's Vineyard. Well, joining us today, live from Madrid, Spain, we welcome back Alex Newman. Alex is an international freelance journalist. He's an author. He's an educator. He's a consultant. His articles appear in The New American, also writes for Freedom Project Media. He is co-author of the book Crimes of the Educators. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, you're at COP25 right now. Before we talk about things going on, explain the name to us, COP25. Sounds like an unusual name for such a conference.
It does, yeah. It officially stands for Conference of the Parties, and this is the 25th one. In reality, they actually have a lot more, but every year they have one big one, and so the little ones don't count, and every year they have the big one, typically at the end of the year. And so this is the 25th.
I'd like you to hit on the hypocrisy of this event. I mean, we keep hearing of the global climate emergency. As a matter of fact, looking at the UNFCCC's website, that United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, here's what they state. As a global climate emergency intensifies and greenhouse gas emissions continue to grow, governments will gather in Madrid for the UN Climate Change Conference, COP25, December 2 through 13, to take the next crucial steps in the UN climate change process. If this is truly, Alex, an intensification of the global climate emergency, why do these people not video conference and instead are flying in from all corners of the world? I'm not sure what the attendance is, but I looked at COP24 in Poland. They had 22,771 registered, including representatives, observers, journalists. I mean, that's a whole lot of carbon emissions. Do they not see the hypocrisy of this?
It really is amazing, Jim. The carbon footprint of these kinds of gatherings is absolutely enormous. I mean, it's unfathomable. And, you know, for me, that doesn't bother me at all. The carbon dioxide is wonderful for the planet. It's an essential gas. In speaking to Dr. William Happer, who served as Trump's climate advisor for several years, you know, Princeton physicist, very, very prestigious scientist, he explained that the Earth is actually starving for more CO2. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, hey, put out as much CO2 as you like. It'll be good for the plants. It'll green the planet. It'll increase agricultural yields. I love it. But the whole premise of this conference is that CO2, the gas you exhale, about 2 pounds of it every single day, is this dangerous, toxic pollution that's going to cook the planet if we don't cut it back. And if the people here really believe that, and, you know, I need to be clear, there are some people here who really do believe that. There's a lot of poor little children who are being, you know, exploited and brainwashed and told that, you know, they're going to die because of the carbon dioxide. So, you know, there's people here who really believe that. But if the leaders, if the organizers of this thing really believe that, you can be sure that they would not be behaving in the way that they're behaving. They would not be feasting on delicious food and running around the city in, you know, armored cars and fleets of armored limos with heavy security. They would not be jetting in on private jets from around the world and flying in huge delegations. You know, the hypocrisy is off the charts. And we're going to be posting some of the video of this. You know, on the one hand, they're lecturing us all that we can't eat meat anymore. We got to get rid of cows. We've got to ban airplanes. On the other hand, they're in there feasting on cheeseburgers and eating caviar and celebrating. It's very, very strange, Jim.
Indeed. And I mean, we even had Speaker Pelosi fly in with her delegation just to announce that the U.S. is still committed to the Paris Climate Agreement. And she said, we came here to say we're still in. This one, President Trump has said, no, we're out. I mean, couldn't she have just sent an email?
You would think so. You know, a video statement probably would have been just fine. But no, you know, they decided that some CO2 emissions are better and worse than other CO2 emissions. And we've actually asked a lot of people at this conference this exact question. I said, well, you know, those CO2 emissions are necessary so we can save the planet. But yes, Pelosi and a whole delegation of Democrats flew over here. They had one senator, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, the guy who literally wanted to prosecute people who don't believe his global warming hypothesis under anti-mafia laws, you know, the RICO statute.
Yeah.
So they all came over here and they made a big show. They said the commitment of Congress to climate action is ironclad, which is, of course, ludicrous, right? If it was, then they would have already passed something, right? They would have had the Senate ratify all these international agreements and we wouldn't be having these conferences. But that's what they want us to think, and they don't mind spewing huge amounts of CO2 to let you know.
Okay, one more question here before we get into COP25, and that is, what is the status of the United States as it relates to the Paris Climate Agreement? President Trump announced he was pulling us out. We know sufficient time has gone by. Nancy Pelosi says we're here to say we're still in. What is truly the status?
It's actually a very difficult question to answer, Jim, and no two people have the same answer. It really depends on who you talk to. So I had a long meeting yesterday with a senior State Department official who's here. There's about 50 Americans from the State Department and different U.S. government agencies representing the United States. Officially, we are still in the Paris Agreement. According to the terms of the agreement, we're not allowed to get out until the day after the next election. So that would be, you know, one day after the 2020 election. And a lot of the State Department bureaucrats here are thinking, hey, Trump's going to lose the election. The next Democrat who wins is just going to get us right back in the Paris Agreement. So let's just, you know, proceed as if nothing were going on. Now, officially, they're not saying that, right? Actually, the U.S., the main U.S. ambassador here, who's, you know, the head of the U.S. delegation, actually gave the three-minute spiel yesterday from the plenary session saying that this is going to be our last COP and we're leaving. But it's a lot more complicated than that. And in fact, I think people really need to understand that the Paris Agreement was never a legitimate agreement to begin with. You know, our Constitution outlines a process for treaty ratification. You know, any kind of international instrument that purports to bind the United States needs to be ratified by two-thirds of the U.S. Senate. This agreement was never presented to the Senate for ratification because Barack Obama knew it had no chance of passing. And so he just called it an executive agreement. So, you know, depending on who you talk to, a lot of constitutional experts will say this whole thing is illegitimate. Even if they could get the Senate to ratify it, the Congress and the President can't just grant new powers to the federal government by signing a treaty. That would be crazy. What would we need a constitution for in that case? But it's a very murky, very confusing legal area, and I think this is done deliberately.
And to your knowledge, this has not actually been challenged in the courts, has it? I mean, has it been introduced at all, where anybody has challenged this, that it's not legitimate to begin with?
There's been a lot of litigation surrounding the Paris Agreement, but again, they did some really interesting legal tricks. So Obama signed us up while in Paris, and I was actually in Paris as well at that summit, another bizarre spectacle. But basically, Obama signed on the dotted line and then started implementing the terms of it through executive orders, through regulations. For example, he had the EPA develop the so-called Clean Power Plan that was going to order, you know, energy producers to drastically slash their CO2 emissions. Now, he could say, hey, that had nothing to do with the Paris Agreement. I just thought the EPA should develop those regulations, and it's within my executive authority. I think a plain and simple reading of the Constitution would show that that's ludicrous. But these are the kind of arguments that they make, and unfortunately, you know, all these lawyers with all their training, you know, they've been taught that this is the way things are done, and, you know, case law and things like that. So it's a very murky legal world. I think it's designed to be confusing on purpose, and they really don't want people asking a lot of questions about these things.
Okay, so you're on the ground there right now in Madrid, Spain. You've been at a very busy day and been a very busy week of conferences and meetings. Give us a first-hand account of what's taking place in COP25.
So there's 25,000 people from all over the world, and their objective is to move forward on this Paris Agreement. And so they, you know, everybody's kind of got their pet issue, but there's a few things that are at the top of the priority list. Officially, they're working on what they call this global carbon market. And even the use of the term carbon is very, very deceptive. It's very misleading. It's supposed to make you think of like black, dirty coal and, you know, nasty, you know, charcoal, things like that. When in reality, we're talking about carbon dioxide. This is an odorless, totally transparent, essential gas, right? All life on this planet depends on carbon dioxide. Again, you exhale 2 pounds of it every single day. And human contributions of CO2 make up a fraction of 1% of all the greenhouse gases present naturally in the atmosphere. But the main objective of this conference is to move forward what they're calling their global carbon markets, where eventually they expect that everyone on Earth, starting with you know, the wealthy countries, they're demanding $100 billion per year from you know, they call them the developed countries, United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, things like that. And so this global carbon market would basically put a price on carbon. The Secretary General today, an actual socialist who was the leader of the Socialist International before becoming the head of the UN, said that it's time for a global tax on carbon dioxide emissions. And I think everybody needs to think about this for a minute. There's nothing that a human being can do, and I mean nothing. You can't sleep, you can't eat, you can't shower, you can't turn on a light switch, you can't even die without CO2 emissions, right? It's just a fundamental part of being alive, and it's not just humans, of course, animals and everything else, and then the plants use that CO2. But if the UN succeeds in developing a system where people have to pay for emitting CO2, there is nothing you can do that would be outside the taxation and the regulatory purview of the United Nations. And that ought to frighten people.
Indeed. Alex, I'd like you to comment on a statement that was made by Patricia Espinoza, the Executive Secretary of UN Climate Change. She said, quote, "This year we have seen accelerating climate change impacts, including increased droughts, storms, and heat waves, with dire consequences for poverty, eradication, human health, migration, and inequality." She said, "The world's small window of opportunity to address climate change is closing rapidly. We must urgently deploy all the tools of multilateral cooperation to make COP25 the launchpad for more climate ambition to put the world on a transformational path toward low carbon and resilience." There is a whole lot packed in that statement.
There sure is, Jim. And, you know, anybody who's been in sales or anybody who's ever bought a used car will recognize these tactics immediately, right? These are high-pressure sales tactics. Actually, the first thing you see when you get off the metro, we decided to be climate neutral, so we took the metro to the COP on the first day when we arrived. And the first thing you see when you get off is billboards all over the place, all over the metro station, all over the street, on the way into the conference, telling you it's no longer climate change. It's now a climate emergency, a climate crisis. So they've changed the rhetoric because they recognize that they need to ramp up the fear-mongering, ramp up the hysteria in order to try to get this through. In America, there really is not much about this in the media. I think that's deliberate. They want this mostly taking place outside the view of the American people. But there really is this incredible escalation in the rhetoric, in the fear-mongering, in the, you know, you must buy now or the opportunity is not going to be here. And so if you look at the speeches that the leaders of the UN, that the speakers here are giving, it's becoming so shrill that, I mean, you'd think you were on like a sinking ship or something. It's very, very weird.
We're going to take a quick break. Alex Newman is in Madrid, Spain right now. He's attending COP25, the UN Global Climate Change Conference. And we'll have some more discussion after the break. But folks, this is more than just dealing with climate. We got social change agents at work as well. We'll get further into that after the break. You're listening to Crosstalk.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, geologist and president of the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, has life been found on meteorites?
No, it hasn't, Chris, even though this fairy tale is continually repeated by my evolutionary colleagues. Microscopic studies of certain meteorites has led them to claim that they have seen hints of past microbial life. But other scientists have studied the same samples and are absolutely convinced that these are really just inorganic crystals or compounds. It's hard to overcome some of these stories once they hit the mainstream press and are repeated over and over again. But the fact is, life has not been found anywhere but on planet Earth, and it's here in abundance, just like we would expect from the Back to Genesis truth of creation.
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called That's a Fact. Visit our web store at icr.org/store and use the promo code FACT at the checkout when ordering your That's a Fact DVD.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. We're talking about COP25. It's happening right now, the UN Global Climate Change Conference in Madrid, Spain. On the scene, Alex Newman giving a report, just attending meetings all day there. It's just after 9 o'clock in the evening local time. We were talking about the statement from Patricia Espinoza from the Executive Secretary of UN Climate Change, and she used that word in her statement here about poverty, eradication, human health, migration, and inequality. What does she mean when she refers to inequality? What does that have to do with climate change?
You know, they've somehow managed to roll up every one of their issues into this climate change thing. It's funny, Greta Thunberg, the little Swedish girl who's being paraded around as some kind of spokesperson for the planet, she actually wrote a column pretty recently, appeared in Project Syndicate, where she explained that it's not enough to just stop the carbon dioxide and save the environment. We also must dismantle patriarchy. We must dismantle capitalism. Mm. We must dismantle past colonial injustices. Again, they're talking about the United States, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, you know, nations that came about that way. And when they talk about inequality, this, you know, I think people need to understand money really makes the world go around in these conferences, and it takes a lot of money to put on shows like this to get all these governments to the table. And I think the simplest way to think of it is just they need a big pot of bribe money. You know, you've got all these governments, you've got all these dictators here, and the UN and really the Western countries are saying to them, hey, you guys need to stay poor. Your people need to continue living in mud huts. Your people need to continue cooking their dinner, their meager dinner, on dung in their mud hut. And, you know, we know your people don't want that. So how are we going to persuade you to keep your people in poverty, to prevent real development, to prevent the emergence of a sustainable electricity grid based on cheap and abundant energy supplies that are available all over the world? And the way they do that is by taking money from taxpayers, primarily in the Western world, and offering it to these dictators. In fact, a lot of these dictatorships, their delegations are flown into Madrid and flown into all these cities at Western taxpayer expense. And then they get there and they say, hey, we're going to create a $100 billion per year pot of money. We're going to say it's for redistributing. You know, Americans are climate criminals and they owe you guys all climate reparations. And so what happens is they tax the poor, the middle class in the United States, in other so-called developed countries, and then they make Americans think and other people think that this money is going somehow to poor people in maybe Africa or Southeast Asia or whatever the case may be, when really it's going into the Swiss bank accounts of the dictators. It's going into the security and the palaces of these dictatorships. And, you know, they want something in return. It's not just they're going to keep their people in poverty and get nothing out of the deal. They expect some of this climate loot under the guise of, you know, solving inequality and climate reparations and all that to make its way into their regimes and into their personal bank accounts.
Yeah, I'd like to just do another tangent on that same theme here, in that we have the UNFCCC also stating that their focus areas at COP25 will include adaptation, loss and damage, transparency, finance, capacity building, indigenous issues, oceans, forestry, gender, and more. We caught that word gender in that statement. Again, begs to go, what does gender have to do with climate change?
Yeah, it's one of the ways they build these huge coalitions, right? They bring in the feminists and they say, hey, we're going to advance feminism using all these policies. And that's exactly what Greta explained in her column, which obviously was written by, you know, her handlers, that we need to also dismantle patriarchy if we're going to save the climate. But that sounds absolutely ludicrous. It just sounds asinine to anybody who's using common sense in their thought process. But this is the kind of rhetoric that passes unchallenged here. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the, you know, the, through the climate thing. We've actually talked before, Jim, about the sustainable development goals. If you look at these, you see all the same rhetoric, all these same ideologies wrapped up in it. And it is part of this global transformation that they're seeking. They want to, you know, dismantle the nuclear family. They want to undermine economic liberty. They want to undermine prosperity. And so that's how gender comes into the picture. They want to add a gender perspective to everything. And, you know, one of the big arguments they're making is that climate change disproportionately affects women. And so, you know, we need to dismantle patriarchy. We need to get all the women out into the workforce. We need to get all the children, starting at the youngest possible ages, into government daycare so that the women can be liberated. And this is what they're pushing.
You mentioned Greta, and she, being this environmental activist, just declared this week as Time Magazine's 2019 Person of the Year. She's the very one who has scolded world leaders in a speech at the UN saying we are in the beginning of a mass extinction.
It really is very sad what's happening here. Yeah, I really have a lot of empathy for her. I think it's terribly sad what her parents are doing, what these so-called world leaders are doing. What they figured out is that it's much more difficult for people to criticize a child than it is to criticize, you know, presidents, prime ministers, UN leaders, dictators. And so they put a child out there as kind of the face of the movement. And they're using Greta as a tool to bring children all over the world into this. And so anywhere you go in the conference, you'll hear, we must listen to the children. We have to listen to the children.
Wow.
It so happened that yesterday I was reading scripture before we went to the conference. I opened up to Proverbs 22, and there it was. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child.
Yes.
And yet you have all these world leaders, you know, bowing down at Greta's feet, pretending like she's speaking truth to power. I think it's terribly cruel of her parents to do this. I think it's terribly cruel of UN leaders to do this. But it really is a good PR strategy, and it's been very effective for them so far.
So we know that, by the way, folks, we're talking with Alex Newman, who is at COP25 right now in Madrid, Spain, writing columns and more to come at thenewamerican.com, thenewamerican.com. Alex, as we've talked about this, part of the goal is having these nations have these climate plans, NDCs, nationally determined contributions. Do we see countries that are active, you know, just saying, yes, this is the direction we're going? What does one of these nationally determined contributions look like?
Yeah, it depends a lot on the country. I should say the government. You know, there's this myth that United Nations is actually a collection of nations. Of course, it's not. It's a collection of governments, and there's a very clear distinction between governments and nations. You know, Robert Mugabe, the late dictator of Zimbabwe, was not a nation. Neither is Xi Jinping or Kim Jong-un or, you know, the Castro brothers, for that matter. But when they talk about, you know, nations coming together and each one is supposed to be coming up with their own plan, what you see is the Western governments have basically agreed to dismantle their productive capacities, right? So if you look at, for example, the commitments that Obama signed up to, we were going to slash CO2 emissions, which, you know, he admitted on television was necessarily going to cause energy prices to skyrocket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's going to happen when our energy prices skyrocket? Factories are going to say, hey, we can't be competitive if we're producing things in the United States. Our energy costs are 10 times higher. Let's go to China. And so what did the communist Chinese dictatorship pledge to do under this Paris Agreement, under their nationally determined contributions? Literally nothing. They said that by 2030, they're maybe going to consider peaking their CO2 emissions. And again, I think CO2 emissions are great. I don't hold it against the people of China or the dictatorship in China for wanting to continue building coal-fired power plants. Their people need energy. Their people have a right to a decent quality of life. And if, you know, if that's the way they want to go, they are perfectly entitled to build power plants. I totally respect that. The problem is when China does nothing and keeps energy costs rock bottom, they've got slave labor, so labor costs are rock bottom. And in America, we've got all these unions, all these regulations, all these crazy climate programs that are going to dismantle our ability to produce energy. We're going to dismantle our factories and our ability to manufacture things. The consequences of this are going to be absolutely devastating for the U.S. economy if it proceeds. You know, right now, Trump has kind of put a stop to it, but that could all change, you know, in 2021. Mm-hmm. If the next president comes in and then a supportive Congress goes along with this.
Yeah, it's amazing that you can get in by just signing your name and take years and years to get out of it.
That's right. It's in my opinion, it's a legal farce. I don't think the U.S. government is obligated in any way to participate in this or to obey the illegitimate terms. It was never ratified by our Senate. As far as I'm concerned, it's an illegitimate agreement. It should not be obeyed. But for whatever reason, the administration is abiding by those terms and is respecting the idea that we can't leave until the day after the election.
One of the stated goals is this push for climate neutrality by the year 2050. Could you give us a picture, Alex? What does that look like? What would that look like here in the United States for them to accomplish this goal of climate neutrality by 2050?
Yeah, there's actually some interesting formulas that have been developed by people. Actually, Bill Gates had a really interesting formula that appeared. He gave, I think, in a TED Talk, and a lot of people were really alarmed by it, so I haven't heard him talking about it much lately. But they had these variables, you know, energy consumption per person, CO2 emissions per person times, you know, population. And so the thinking is either you have to reduce the population, or you have to reduce the consumption, or you have to reduce both to the point where humanity is not a net emitter of CO2, of carbon dioxide. And so to do that, you need some combination of reducing the human population, reducing the consumption of the humans that continue to exist, and methods of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere somehow. And so they say, okay, well, you're not allowed to cut down any forests, and you have to plant, you know, they've been doing this in Africa for quite some time, the carbon credit companies, you know, they'll go and they'll evict an entire African village and say they're going to plant some trees there. And so that gives you like a carbon credit. So that's like a negative on your CO2 accounting budget. And then that gives you permission to emit a little bit of CO2 from, you know, your power plant or whatever. So that's really what we're talking about here. And a lot of people here are very open about the fact that we are going to drastically need to reduce the human population. And in fact, we've got videos of people telling us to our face, we need to cut the number of humans. We need coercive measures. We need mandatory birth control. The Chinese are doing something right. A few years ago at one of these COPs, I think it was in Copenhagen, I was there, the communist Chinese government bragged about how they had reduced CO2 emissions by X amount through their one-child policy. And they showed that there would have been, you know, 300 million additional births, and each one of those human beings would have emitted X amount of CO2. And so we reduced our carbon footprint by, you know, Y amount. And this is, you know, I think very troubling. It's very anti-human. But it is, you know, the mainstream narrative here within this COP25 bubble where all these people tend to agree with this.
Alex, as you've been sitting there through meetings, you've been hearing statements, is there anything that has just really stood out to you as being really significant that the American people need to know what's happening there?
Yeah, we actually just published a video right now where a gentleman told me, you know, I asked him, you know, about population, and he said, hey, I'm looking at you, white man, don't have any more children, right? And then he went on to talk about how we need coercive policies to enforce these kinds of limits. Also, there's a very well-known, a very prominent organization here. Every day they do the Fossil of the Day Awards to demonize whatever government they think is being least cooperative as part of this process. The organization is called Climate Action Network, CAN. It's actually a network of many, many other organizations. And we found out, just they've been demonizing the United States every single day. A couple of days ago, the U.S. government got first, second, and third place for being the best at being the worst. And, you know, they demonized Trump, they demonized Americans, they said we're evil for pulling energy out of the ground, we're evil for not giving them more money, we're evil for not participating in this process as fully as they think we should. Again, today, the United States got first place in the Fossil of the Day Award, and it took me all of 2 seconds to find out some incredible information that has not yet been reported by any one of the thousands of journalists here. The Climate Action Network, their largest financier, according to the Heartland Institute, is a very shadowy foundation called the Sea Change Foundation. Well, I looked into the Sea Change Foundation, and actually I wrote an article about them in 2015. The U.S. Congress had released a report investigating the Sea Change Foundation. It turned out it had been receiving funds from a shell corporation based in Bermuda called Klein Limited, and this corporation was getting Russian money to demonize American oil.
Let me have you just stop right there. It's too important for us to miss what you have to say here. Let's take a quick break. Alex Newman is with us. He's in Madrid, Spain. His columns you can find at thenewamerican.com. Back in 1 minute, you're listening to Crosstalk.
Christmas has become ground zero in an ongoing culture war where nativity scenes are nixed, Merry Christmas becomes Happy Holidays, and even the word Christmas is considered by some as offensive. Addressing this ongoing battle is the book The War on Christmas, edited by Bodie Hodge from Answers in Genesis. With full-color pictures and illustrations throughout, The War on Christmas provides answers concerning a host of issues and misconceptions surrounding Christmas. You'll learn where the name Christmas comes from. Is it a pagan holiday? What about replacing Christ with the letter X? You'll find chapters on the Christmas star, the virgin birth, the magi, why creation is important to Christmas, and so much more. This book also presents the gospel, which is often lost as this time is celebrated. The War on Christmas is available for a donation of $18 by calling VCY America at 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
Our program takes us to Madrid, Spain today, where Alex Newman is attending COP25, the UN Global Climate Change Conference. This is the 25th Conference of the Parties that is underway. And Alex, you were indicating that something that no media is reporting on is this Climate Action Network, the Sea Change Foundation. Tell us more here. I know that break kind of interrupted us.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Jim, for the opportunity to talk about this. We actually broke this story, and it's been picked up. Climate Depot, which is the number one climate skeptic website in the world, has republished our article. But as far as the mainstream media is concerned, they don't want to touch this because it's real Russia collusion. But what happened is you have this Climate Action Network. They're staging these funny little skits showing how horrible Trump is and how evil Americans are, and we're all just greedy and, you know, how dare us not want to give reparations for our climate emissions to every third world dictator. And it turns out this Climate Action Network, their largest financier, according to the Heartland Institute, it's a think tank in the United States, has been the Sea Change Foundation. Turns out the Sea Change Foundation, and I actually made a minor error before the break. I said that this report had come out in 2016. It actually, the congressional report came out in 2018. But this was a report by the Republican, at that time, majority in the U.S. House. And they put out this report where they investigated all these different sources of funding that were funding the environmental movement in the United States. And one of them, of course, was the Sea Change Foundation, and they learned that the Sea Change Foundation was getting some of its funding from a shell corporation based in Bermuda called Klein Limited. And this congressional report found that Klein Limited was being funded by Putin's cronies and by Russian energy interests. And so what the congressional investigators concluded is that this was the Russian regime, which is very heavily dependent on energy exports to Europe and to other parts of the world. You know, it's 50% of their exports is actually energy and fossil fuels, ironically. And so they were using this shell corporation to fund all these environmental groups in the United States and in Europe, demanding that we stop extracting energy resources from the ground in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, which, of course, would have the effect of making Europe completely dependent on Russian energy to be able to keep the lights on, to keep their homes heated in the winter and all that. So this is very troubling. It's a legitimate example of Russia collusion. We did ask the Climate Action Network about this today. We got several no comments, and then we got this is not an appropriate time or place to ask that question. I'm not quite sure why that was, because they said they were taking questions and interviews from journalists. But that's the story. We also tried to ask the Russians, but nobody was at their office when we stopped by, so we will ask again tomorrow.
Wow, wow. Alex, you wrote an article saying we can expect more global governance from COP25. Explain that.
Yeah, so global governance is a term that these people use a lot because it sounds less intimidating than global government. But really what they're talking about is global government. They're talking about new taxation powers for the United Nations. That's been one of the big restraining influences on the UN, is the fact that it has to actually depend on member states for money. You know, if it had its own taxation authority, which is where this is all going, then it wouldn't have to beg the United States for money. It wouldn't have to beg the French and the Chinese and the Japanese for money. They could just do whatever they wanted. And so global taxes on CO2 is really at the top of the agenda, and there's several different paths they're pursuing to make that happen. One is they want global taxes on air travel through the International Civil Aviation Organization, which, ironically or not, is actually led by an agent of Communist China, a member of the Communist Chinese Party. So you have all these different avenues they're pursuing to strengthen global governance, to give new powers to these global agencies. There has even been serious talk here, and even before the conference started, of using UN military forces, they call them peacekeeping forces, to enforce climate mandates and climate decrees on entire nations.
Oh, my.
incredible stuff. And that's what they're talking about. You know, and this seems normal to the people here, but that's why they don't really report it in the United States. The American people would put their foot down immediately, mm-hmm. and the whole clown show would come to an end.
Are you finding that these conferences, that they're becoming just more and more radical as time goes on, as each conference comes about?
They absolutely are. And, you know, it's funny because the scientific evidence continues to grow, showing that the hypothesis is incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, you know, human emissions of CO2 are driving some sort of catastrophic climate change. So the science is actually on the side of the skeptics or the realists, as they like to call themselves. But the tone at these UN conferences is getting more and more shrill. I've been coming to these for 10 years now, fresh out of journalism school. I went in 2009 to the one in Copenhagen, and I have never seen the kind of extreme, I mean, it's always been extreme, but I've never seen it this extreme where they're, I mean, terrifying little children. They're telling them you're all going to die if you don't, yeah. you know, do what we say right now. And it really seems like, you know, I haven't gotten this impression in the past, but it's just so much more obvious now. They talk about, quote-unquote, science as if it were like this god that needed to be obeyed. They said, science demands that you all pay carbon taxes. Science demands that we quit consuming. Science demands that we cut the population, as if science could speak. You know, science, of course, is a process for discovering truth. It's not an entity that can give us orders, but you wouldn't know that from being at this climate summit.
Wow. Friends, we're opening our lines. Our number 800-733-9829. That's 1-800-733-9829. And then, Alex, we need to continue to look at what happens domestically with this, because, as you mentioned, one day after the election is when we'd be out. But if President Trump is overtaken in this next election, we stay in. And I find it also interesting that Fox News is just reporting that Elizabeth Warren has released an addendum to her version of the Green New Deal, released it on Tuesday this week, is called the Blue New Deal, in which she is looking to reinstate former President Obama's so-called clean water rule.
It's amazing. And, you know, this clean water rule, for people who don't remember, basically declared that everything essentially is, you know, if it's in any way connected to navigable waters, officially becomes waters of the United States and has been subject to federal regulation. And so what happened during the Obama administration, any puddle that they could find on a farm, they'd say, oh, you know, that's somehow connected to navigable waters, because if it grows, it's going to go into this creek and it'll go into a river. And so your entire property is now subject to EPA control and EPA regulations. It was a monstrosity, and that's why one of the first things Trump did was actually repeal that rule. And that was, you know, a huge blessing to ranchers and farmers and property owners and even homeowners. But, you know, it's very alarming that Democrats are openly calling for these kinds of things.
Taking your calls here, number 800-733-9829. Let's begin in Sussex, Wisconsin. Joseph, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Alex, for the work you do. I appreciate it very much. I've been, shall we say, monitoring the preaching of about a dozen local churches around our area here. And an observation that I have is that it appears that they're abandoning exegesis, verse-by-verse preaching of the Bible, and they're kind of adopting and adapting rhetorical inventions, I would say. Words like intentional, transformational, the Jesus way, formational, etc. Do you see a linkage there between the language being used in churches and the language being used in this climate?
Thank you, Joseph, for that. And Alex, with that, we're seeing the religious community come on board to adopt these UN policies as well.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much to the caller. And I think you just hit on such an important point. I've observed the exact same thing happening. It's coming into a lot of seminaries now where the pastors are being trained. And this has been my experience, too. I'll give you another example. I was in Poland last year for the COP24. It was held in Katowice. One of the people that we interviewed, there was many, you know, self-proclaimed Christian leaders and ministers and things like this. One of the people that I interviewed was a bishop in the Episcopalian Church from California. I believe it was San Francisco. And I asked him, you know, he's very friendly, super nice. We had a nice conversation on camera about, you know, the climate. And he made, you know, what he explained were biblical arguments in favor of, you know, submitting to this global climate regime and so on. And then at the end of the interview, I said to him, hey, you know, leave all that aside now. And, you know, you're a Christian minister. Why should people, and I just gave him such a softball, you know, why should people put their trust in Christ? Why should people believe that the Bible is God's word? And, you know, I expected just right away just a proclamation of the gospel and God's love to people. And instead, you know, almost an exact quote, "Well, you know, that's what I believe, but I don't want to tell other people what to believe."
Oh, my.
And, you know, for me, that was just incredible.
Yeah.
What Christian would ignore or would not seize upon an opportunity to preach the gospel to
people?
I couldn't understand it. Saving the climate is more important than saving people's souls. It really struck me as odd, and I haven't been able to let go of that. I haven't been able to forget that since last year. And I'm very concerned about the infiltration of this rhetoric into our church. It's not just on the climate stuff. I mean, you know, the environmental and the climate stuff is huge,
mm-hmm.
but it's on all these different globalist agendas. You know, now the Southern Baptist Convention, and I actually go to an SBC church. So, you know, I don't mean to throw stones, but they recently adopted a resolution on critical race theory, saying that this was a useful analytical tool. And they did say it needs to be subordinate to Scripture, obviously. But, you know, this is not biblical in any way. God doesn't even talk about races in the Bible. So why are we talking about
yeah,
races?
Yeah.
I'm very troubled by all this, and I appreciate